I'm John Batchelor with David Petrucha, the historian and author of the new book, Roosevelt Sweeps Nation. It's campaign time. Alf Landon and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the nominees of the major parties. And we begin with the Landon campaign because there's not a great deal to say except for why there isn't a great deal to say. David, Landon does not attend the convention that nominates him. What happens afterwards to remember? Thank you.
Well, he makes up for not being there by not being there, by going on vacation for 2 weeks at a ritzy dude ranch, essentially, in Colorado, and then not doing anything for another few weeks while his campaign staff goes out there, but he doesn't. But when he finally does go out there, he's more energetic. He's still a bad speaker, but he gives a series of speeches at the end of the campaign or towards the end on the tariffs, on agriculture, and most horribly on Social Security, already the third rail of American politics, and proceeds to just lose chunk after chunk of electoral support.
We should mention there are polling results from this summer of 1936 that are striking. I have from your reporting, David, in July of 1936, the Gallup poll, George Gallup's poll, records 272 electoral votes for Landon, 259 for Roosevelt, giving Landon the presidency. However, a month later, late August, we have 274 for Roosevelt and 257 for Landon. So the momentum suddenly switches somewhere between July and August. Does the Republican Party react, David?
The Republican Party continues to pour money and speakers and organization into the race. But absent a compelling candidate, and actually absent a compelling message, because Landon continues to be this sort of progressive Republican, and he's promising just to be more efficient. He's not going to really tinker that much with the New Deal, and he had supported it throughout his earlier tenure as governor of Kansas. But so the message is, we'll just keep doing what we're doing, only we're going to do it better. And that is not as compelling as a message as Franklin Roosevelt has, which is, I've already done this. I've done all this for you, and I'm going to protect you from these bad rich guys.
There is a moment, again, you can't make this stuff up, where the two candidates meet. They're crisscrossing the country. It's, my note says September 3rd, FDR and Alf Landon meet in Des Moines, and they're polite to each other. Does Roosevelt leave a memory of what he makes of him at that point?
Well, Rex Tugwell, the famed brain truster, says he thought that Landon was an extremely nice person. And they are so pleasant to each other. The Senator Capper of Kansas says he half expected one of the candidates to withdraw and endorse the other. I'm not sure which would have done that. But it is a remarkably cordial meeting. And the circumstances are, because talk about climate change, there was a massive heat wave that summer, not the Dust Bowl, but a heat wave where the temperatures are over 100 in Kansas when Landon gets the nomination, 120 in one place in North Dakota, and the girders are warping. The steel is warping in New York City from the heat.
The important detail here I pick up from David's reporting is that radio was extremely new to America. Not everyone had a radio set. It was something to aspire to. And on the radio, presentations were making men, especially, stars. And one of the stars we've already talked about, Father Coughlin. Another star, Franklin Roosevelt. At the time, how was Landon's presentation on the radio regarded? Did they note it, David?
Well, Father Coughlin actually critiques him to the chair of the Republican National Committee and says he's never heard anything this bad in his life, that the accents all come on at the wrong part of the sentences. And he advises the chairman, John Hamilton, to get him off the campaign trail and to have him make no more speeches and to tell the public, Hamilton says, I can't do that. And Coughlin says, yes, you can. Just say that he broke a leg and just make up a story. Get this guy out of the camp, off the campaign trail.
Walter Lippmann is not kind to anyone because that was his job. He wrote of Landon, dull and uninspired fellow, an ignorant man of no account. Now, that was during the campaign, so you could regard that as prejudicial. But in any event,
well, he endorsed Landon. That's what his supporters were saying.
All these decades later, you do puzzle about whether they did any research whatsoever into how Landon got elected, because he was never a good campaigner. This wasn't discontinuous. This was his style. He was just going to fall into the presidency. Now we move over to the Democratic campaign and Roosevelt's campaign. Important here is that he goes on a train to take the Western swing, and eventually they'll swing through New England. Eleanor Roosevelt is on the train. Is she an important element of his campaign at this time? Do they regard her as a tool they can use to their advantage?
When it starts, even though she's been in the news more so than any other first lady, visiting those coal mines and at such and such and such, both the Democrats and the Republicans don't think this is a winning strategy for the Democratic campaign. The Republicans hide Alf Landon's wife, who might have been the best part of the campaign. She's very young, very attractive, photogenic. And the Democrats want to hide Eleanor, too. When Roosevelt goes off on that campaign trail, they don't want her on the platform. They think that maybe she's too much for 1936 America. And they're wrong. They're wrong. When she steps out on that platform, she's the star as much as Franklin Roosevelt. And when the Democrats go off on that train trip through southern New England at the end of the campaign, the crowds are just immense, like 150,000 people in Rhode Island. And just the crowds are so frenzied in their enthusiasm that Eleanor is afraid that people might actually get hurt or killed.
It's important now to connect Eleanor to a part of the campaign that turns out to be most important, which is the African-American vote. There isn't much for campaigning in the South because of the brutality of the segregationists, the racists. However, in the North, the vote is extremely important in large cities. And Eleanor is the bridge. David has very careful reporting about how Eleanor handled this. Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt were people of their time. Their language sometimes was unacceptable to us in the 21st century. But the two details that were important to African-Americans, who were harder hit than any demography in a demographic group in the U.S. by the severe downturn, the collapse of confidence in the economy, and they accounted for the relief plans. Generally, it was called reliefers. They accounted for the relief plans, getting a paycheck, whether it was the CCC working outside, or any of the opportunities to get work for the government. That was important to the African-American vote in the North. But Eleanor campaigned for the anti-lynching law, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt didn't support it, David. Did he use Eleanor? Did Eleanor ignore him because she was for it? Did that in any way cause controversy in the Democratic Party?
Well, that Eleanor-Franklin relationship was always, shall we say, complex. And Franklin supplies the cash. He supplies the jobs. He supplies the programs. But he doesn't supply the love. He doesn't supply the respect that Eleanor Roosevelt so famously supplies and will supply for the black community. They're doing things differently. Eleanor wants to push the anti-lynching law. The NAACP wants to push it. Franklin says, nope, I can't do it. I can't get it through the Congress. I can't get it through the Senate. I can't get it past the Southern Democrats. I wish I were given a different hand to play in creating this new deal, but I will not jeopardize my program. I will not sacrifice the safety of the nation for this. Whether he thinks this is the case or not, or whether he's just not that interested, it remains to be seen. One very high-ranking black official says, look, he just didn't care about us. He was a patrician, and he was just cold as ice towards us. So it's they're covering the bases, but they are covering the bases separately in winning the black vote. And the black vote is key in the North.
And in New York City and in Chicago and in the large cities that Roosevelt is worried about. And we come now to, I think, the high point of the campaign. David presents it very carefully, the swing through New York, the state that Roosevelt comes from can be in doubt because of all these factions. He travels to the Brooklyn Academy of Music and makes a speech on the 30th. And then Eleanor's in town campaigning ferociously up and down town, shaking hands, meeting people on the street. However, Roosevelt, the president, makes a presentation at the Madison Square Garden, Halloween night, October 31st, is my note from David. And he makes a speech that peels paint, David. This would peel paint today as well. What is he thinking at this straight-up class warfare speech?
Well, he started with the class warfare in his December 1935 State of the Union address. Follows that up at the Philadelphia Convention. We remember that for Rendezvous with Destiny. His favorite phrase there is the economic royalists. We means the rich guys, the business interests, Wall Street, etc. And then he says at Madison Square Garden, again, how these wealthy individuals, business and influential interests are could be oppressive, could create a dictatorship over the economic interests of the working people. And so he says, I welcome their hatred. And he says it as one syndicated columnist says, you really had to hear his words. On paper, it was one thing, but hearing the intonation, it was just frenzied and irate. And he says, and I would hope that in my second administration, they would meet their master. And people in his administration are at the fringes of it, like Ray Moley, the rather estranged brain truster at that point, or the Secretary of Labor, Francis Perkins, or his pollster, Emil Herja, are all like coming out of that event saying, whoa, he's gone too far. But in fact, maybe he hasn't.
Yes, Moley's horrified. All the speechwriters, or the pollster, Emil Herja, is appalled. They recount, they think we might now be in trouble. Moley says, thoughtful citizens were stunned by the violence, the bombast, the naked demagoguery of these sentences. David, they read wonderfully. They're really well read. No one who has merely read them can half know the meaning conveyed by the cadences of the voice that uttered them. So Moley's saying it wasn't just the language, it was the way FDR delivered it. And we now turn to why it is there were all these doubts about his reelection. What we're about to see is a swamping of the Electoral College and a swamping of the popular vote. What preyed on them, David? Was it just that they were wise not to be overconfident? Were they taking their cue from the president? Because certainly by this time he had some sense that Landon was a poor campaigner and that the people were with him. So where was the major anxiety in the campaign?
One of the reasons why Landon was being boosted at first is there was a sense that the public was no longer so concerned about relief and the depression, but wanted greater economy in government. And they were concerned about the deficits, concerned about too much spending. And this was continuing all through 35 and 36. At the beginning of 36, Gallup has a poll, or no, the Literary Digest has a poll. And 62% of the people say they're no longer crazy about the New Deal, which is a complete flip from what it had been like during the midterms or a year earlier when 62% were in favor of it. So there was a sliding of public opinion, but also, you know, the Great Depression was still going on. At the November 1936, the unemployment rate is still, with tens of millions of people on the federal payroll or getting relief and with a big deficit, 13.9%. This is not what I would call a robust recovery.
Roosevelt sweeps nation. FDR's 1936 landslide and the triumph of the liberal ideal. David Petrucha is the author. When we come back, election night and the surprise. This is John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.